All right. Good morning, everyone. How are you? Keeping well? Everyone okay? Yeah? Good. Okay, glad to hear that. So, we are going to carry on, surprise, surprise. And we're going to continue with this beautiful teaching in the Majjhima Nikaya 27, which is normally known as the the gradual training. And it is the idea here is that it looks at the training from the very beginning to the very end of the path. So it's very interesting in many ways. And you will find that all of us, we kind of fit in on that training somewhere. And you can kind of map your own progress and see what you have to do, where you have to go, and all of these kind of things. It's a very interesting sutta, apart from being the one that introduced Buddhism to Sri Lanka. That's also very exciting. There's many sides to this particular teaching here. And I didn't mention yesterday, but one of the ways of deciding that a particular sutta or a particular exposition is important. How do we know that a particular teaching is important? Well, we looked at some of those criteria initially. We looked at the idea the Buddha says the 37 aids to awakening. Yeah, this is kind of what the Dhamma is about. That's a very important criteria. But another very important criterion is how often does the Buddha talk about a particular subject, right? If the Buddha mentions something again and again, different audiences, different places, we can assume that it must be a core part of these teachings. And the gradual training, you find that everywhere. You find it in the middling sayings about 10 times maybe. I haven't really counted it. Probably I should count it before I say anything, but roughly about 10 times. In the long discourse of the Buddha, you find an expanded version, maybe 11 times. You find it also in the numerical discourses. This is like a standard exposition that we're looking at. And what it really is, when you start looking at it, it is really just an expansion of the Noble Eightfold Path. That's what it is, like the detailed exposition of the Noble Eightfold Path. So in that sense, it's actually very interesting, and you can see how it fits in with the overall ideas of the Dhamma. So yesterday we had a look at the idea of a Buddha arising in the world, and we talked about what that means, and we talked about the kind of qualities of the Buddha and the kind of qualities that the Buddha himself recommends that we should think of when we reflect on the Buddha. And of course, the idea behind the Buddha arising in the world is the idea of right view arising in the world. The Buddha has an insight into the nature of reality. And then in the suttas, the Buddha is often called the eye of the world, because the Buddha sees, and then he passes on what he has seen to the rest of us. He becomes the eye for everyone else. I see the nature of reality, I pass it on to all of us here, right? The Buddha passes on to us. So when we read the suttas, it's like we are getting that information from the Buddha, passing it on. And so this is kind of the underlying idea. One person has this profound insight, everyone else gets to benefit because they pass it on to the world. And I think on the spiritual path, it is always useful to have a degree of humility about our own limits and about what we can do. It is very easy to overestimate one's own abilities in the spiritual way. You often hear people say, I'm going to do this all by myself, I don't want any teachers, I'm just going to do it. But even the Buddha had teachers. The Buddha started out, he had the two famous teachers, Alara Kalama and Uddaka Ramaputta. These are two of the teachers talked about in the suttas. He also mentions that he had more teachers than that. So even the Buddha-to-be took on board the existing spiritual possibilities. He kind of listened to the teachers of the time because he realized, well, I should listen to those people who have some insight and understanding, have some degree of experience with these things, and then, if necessary, take it further, if that actually seems to be necessary down the track or whatever. So the idea to kind of have a sense of humility about this path and use the teachings that are available is important. Just as if you want to become a lawyer, you go to law school. If you want to become a carpenter, you go to, I don't think you go to carpenter school. Is that what it's called? Now you go some kind of college or whatever it is to learn to be a carpenter. But you learn from people with experience. There's no point in starting from scratch. It's kind of crazy here. So the idea is then, okay, what does the Buddha have to say here? Maybe I should kind of follow the teachings of the Buddha. Maybe start with this anyway and see if it makes sense. That is kind of a good way of thinking about this. The Buddha opens up. He says specifically, I've seen the nature of reality. Yeah? I'm letting you know out of compassion because there's something that everyone in the world should really understand. Because once you understand the nature of reality, then you can make good choices. Without seeing things as they are, how can you possibly make good choices? It's impossible, right? It's like in ordinary life. If you are deluded about something, how can you make good choices? If you think that the meal, the breakfast is down there, but when actually it is up there, you're going to walk in that direction, there's no breakfast. That's called suffering, right? Well, where's the breakfast? I can't find the breakfast anywhere. That's kind of the nature of delusion. We follow delusion, you suffer. That's just the way it is. And it's exactly the same on the spiritual path. If you're heading in the bad direction because you don't understand what's going on, you're going to suffer. You have a problem as a consequence. So the Buddha opens up a possibility here. And this is kind of what this is about that we're seeing here. He sees the nature of reality here. And what is kind of interesting about the things that we were reading out yesterday here, the idea is that, you know, if you look at that overall, what the Buddha is talking about there, he's basically talking about seeing reality, understanding things, and then about being a teacher. These are the two kind of sides of what it is about. It's a very simple idea what the Buddha is, but of course that has enormous consequences. But there's nothing there about supernatural things, nothing there about weird stuff. Even though yesterday I went a bit off on a tangent and we had some ghost stories yesterday and we had some good fun. I really enjoy that kind of stuff. But even though we went a bit off on a tangent, that is not really what the Buddha is talking about. At the very most, you could say the idea of rebirth is included in that. But it's very down to earth, right? And this is, I think, one of the things that characterizes the Buddha and the way he teaches and the whole Dhamma experience. It is really down to earth. There will be challenging things. There will be things about rebirth. There will maybe be things about other realms of existence that do challenge us. But if the Dhamma didn't challenge you at all, would it have any value? Things that don't challenge us, that just kind of confirm our existing biases and kind of illusions, they're kind of not all that useful. So we should expect the Dhamma to challenge us. And when the Dhamma does challenge us, that is actually what makes it, to my mind, fascinating. So it is that middle way between not being completely wacky. Is that the word you use over here? Yeah, wacky, yeah. So not completely wacky, but at the same time challenging us a little bit. Yeah, it's always about this kind of middle way here. We're often coming back to this idea of the middle way again and again. So the Buddha arrives in the world. Right view has arisen. This makes the Noble Eightfold Path possible because it starts with right view. So what happens next? He is the teacher of gods and humans, awakened and blessed. And then comes the second part of this paragraph. He realizes with his own insight this world, with its gods, Maras, Brahmas, this population with its ascetics and Brahmins, gods and humans. And it makes it known to others. He teaches a Dhamma that is good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end, meaningful and well-phrased. And he reveals a spiritual practice that is entirely complete and pure. So, here he goes on a little bit more and says a little bit more about what he has realized. Again, it's with his own insight. This is always important Everything in Buddhism is about the Buddha's own insight. He doesn't take on metaphysical ideas or anything from the prevailing culture or the, you know, the Brahmanical culture, whatever. He always realizing, he looks into things. That's kind of the nature of the Buddha. He's not someone to take things on board just on faith, but it is about insight and understanding. So he realizes with his own insight this world. So what is this world? And this is kind of the point here. This world is this world. It has gods, Maras, Brahmas again. Right? So these ideas are ideas that existed in that culture, especially the idea of Brahmas was the main god of the Brahmanical people, but also all subsidiary kind of gods. So the Buddha is saying, well, actually, I understand all of this. I've seen all of these things. I know what they mean, what they really are all about. And so he's kind of taking a, he's basically saying, kind of taking a position above everything else. It's like he's saying, I have the bird's eye view. I've gone beyond all of this. And because I've gone beyond all of this, I understand how these things fit in to the overall view of reality. And this is kind of the idea of having a, if you have a deep insight into the nature of reality, you should expect that person to understand how other teachings, other religions, other philosophies, other ideas, how they kind of fit into that overall view of reality. That's what you would expect if someone really has an overarching bird's eye view and sees what is going on. Yeah. So he will be able to fit in these ideas of Brahma, Mara, and gods, fit that into that overall view of reality. Maybe that view is that they don't exist, that's one possibility. Or if they do exist, exactly how they exist. Are they permanent, impermanent? What are the nature of these gods, etc., etc. And then he talks about, he has seen this population with his ascetics and Brahmins, with his own insight. What does that mean? What does it mean to see this population with its ascetics and Brahmins? And I think it is this idea that once you have a bird's eye view of the nature of everything, you understand how other teachers, other teachings, you understand the limitations of those teachings, you understand to what extent they align with that reality that you have seen. Yeah, so you can actually put them in context and you know whether they will lead to anything good or whether they lead to anything bad, etc. Buddhism is not exclusive in the sense that all other teachings are evil. Buddhism is more like you look at those other teachings and you look at them from the perspective of what we consider the truth, and then you will say, well, to this extent they are also true, to this extent they are bad. This is the idea of Buddhism. It's not kind of an exclusivist thing. It's more like understanding of reality. And this makes Buddhism, to my mind, much more interesting because it doesn't really, it kind of includes, in, if you like, other teachings in a more kind of reasonable way, if you wish. So the Buddha will understand all of these philosophies, all of these teachings, where they lead, how they go, etc. And I think this is what this is, the meaning of this. And then again, gods and humans again. So probably just an expansion on the same thing. And it makes it known to others, right? This is what the Buddha does. And this is where the Dhamma begins, when he makes it known to others. He has compassion for the world, and this is the reality. Please, listen, I've got this vital message to tell you. That's kind of fascinating. How do we know whether to listen to someone like the Buddha? If you met the Buddha, would you listen to him? Or her, maybe? I don't know, maybe female Buddhas can be had as well. Would you listen to a Buddha? If you met a Buddha, if you were walking down the street, Pleasant Street, is that what it's called out here? You're walking down Pleasant Street and you meet some weirdo in robes with a shaven head and he says, listen, I have discovered the truth. You probably take a detour, right? You probably kind of avoid that person. You kind of feel, whoa, this is scary. This person, not to be trusted. Probably some kind of someone has gone a bit funny or whatever. How easy is it when you meet someone who makes this kind of claim to actually believe it, right? I mean, it's hard, right? Because very often people will say, I am God, I am Jesus. I mean, most of the time they are, they have lost the plot a little bit, to put it that way. And so it's difficult, right? And so you have to be very, very careful. And it's one of those kind of marvelous stories in the suttas. This is just after the Buddha's awakening. This is found in the Noble Search. It's a very, very beautiful sutta. Please, you know it already. It's about the Buddha talks about his awakening experience and how he kind of walks from his awakening place to Benares and then meets the five ascetics and all of this. It's a beautiful, the beginning, how Buddhism really comes about. And at the start of that story, after the Buddha's awakening, he is walking towards Benares, Varanasi, this wonderful city in India. We can still go in the present day. As he's walking there, he meets this wanderer. He's actually a Jivaka ascetic, one of the other religions at that time. And his name is Upaka. And so he meets this Upaka, and Upaka looks at the Buddha. And you can imagine, this is the Buddha just after awakening, right? So it's going to be a pretty powerful sight. Here is this person, just after awakening, at his most powerful time. His mind is probably extremely still. And Upaka looks at the Buddha and says, "Wow, what happened to you?" He doesn't put it exactly that way, but that's basically what he's saying. You look amazing. You are kind of radiating, and you are just wow, out of this world. Basically, what's going on? And then he asks, "Who was your teacher?" Because this is the way that you ask an ascetic in ancient India to make them qualify as the real deal. They have to have a teacher. Who was your teacher? What is your lineage? And this kind of stuff. Someone asked about lineage. Was it here the other day? Yeah. And then the Buddha says, actually, I have no teacher. I'm self-awakened. And he says something like, I'm the victor in the world because I've defeated all kind of bad states or something. I can't remember exactly how the Pali goes. And then this Upaka says, well, you're kind of claiming to be some kind of universal conqueror or something. And the Buddha kind of carries on. Yes, basically. Yeah, that's basically what I'm saying. And he kind of carries on with a few verses. And then Upaka goes, right. And he kind of shakes his head, wags his tongue, and walks off in the wrong direction, right? And of course, this idea of walking off in the wrong direction has a very heavy symbolic meaning here. Because he is face to face with awakening, face to face with the most profound insight in reality, and he doesn't grasp it, he doesn't get it. And he walks off in the wrong direction, having the opportunity to practice the Noble Eightfold Path, getting the best teacher there is, but not actually seeing it. And I think that is kind of a problem in the world. Yeah, many of us would make that mistake. Often I hear people, especially in traditional Buddhist countries, they say, well, yeah, Buddhism is kind of dying out now. It's not really, there are no noble ones left in the world, all the arahants, and it doesn't exist anymore. I'm going to wait for the next Buddha. That's what you hear. It's very common to hear that in Buddhist circles. But if you did meet the next Buddha, would you even recognize the next Buddha? You probably wouldn't, right? You probably walk off in the wrong direction like Upaka, and you kind of have no idea what was going on. And so this is the kind of the danger here. It's actually difficult to pick out people who are enlightened. It's difficult because our minds are going in such a different direction. Very hard to see. And so when the Buddha, and this is why probably the Buddha said precisely at the beginning, I don't really want to teach, because no one will understand anyway. So this is what is kind of the Buddha is faced with here when he is presenting the Dhamma in the world. He makes it known to others, but only some people will get it. And I think this is the reason why he starts off teaching the five ascetics, right? Because they were already his friends. They would know him, and that makes it easier for him to approach them because of that. So, he makes it known to others. And fortunately, there were some people who did listen. So that's why we have Buddhism today. Otherwise, we wouldn't have Buddhism today. So are you guys ready to listen? Yeah? Okay, good. Okay, I got the right crowd here. So we are. So let's listen more. So what does he teach then? He teaches the Dhamma. This is how the Dhamma comes into existence, right? That is good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end. Yeah, this is, I think, a very important part of what the Dhamma is about. The idea that it always has good effects. From the... Oops, this is all getting recorded. Oh, well. So, the Dhamma is good in the beginning, right? We should have good beneficial effects straight away. You start living well, you feel good about yourself. You do a bit of meditation, you enjoy the meditation. If you don't enjoy the meditation, I should have said this on the first night, I didn't mention that. If you don't enjoy it, change something, do it differently, or stop. Make sure that you don't meditate against your wishes or if it feels bad to you. There are some people who have bad reactions to meditation practice, and that's okay. You don't have to be a super-duper meditator. And if you have a bad reaction, it's just part of what it means to be a human being. It's fine. Please don't do it if you have a bad reaction, because otherwise you're going to destroy the potential for meditation practice in your life. If you have a bad reaction, let it be. Do other things which are part of the Buddhist path. Live well, be generous, be kind, all of these kind of things, and then try it again down the track, maybe a few months' time or whatever. But don't force yourself to do something which doesn't work, because that is not what this is about. So it's good from the very beginning, yeah? What we're doing here should have a positive effect from the very start. It's good in the middle, when your meditation really comes together. Wow, this is just amazing, yeah? All the happiness and joy that can be found on this path. And it's good at the very end, when you have the deep insights into the nature of reality. Every step of the way is good. You never think, oh, I wish I hadn't done this. This was a bad idea, right? That never really happens on this path. It is just joy upon joy upon joy here. Happiness begetting more happiness. Yeah, it is not pain leads to happiness. No, it's happiness leads to happiness. This is kind of the wonder of this path. So this is a very important point. And if you're not really enjoying this path, you have to ask yourself, what's going on here? Why is this the case? The Buddha says it should be a happy path. Okay, let me try to adjust something. Let me try to investigate what is going on. Let me ask someone who might know more than I and try to make it into a positive experience. So good in the beginning, good in the end, middle and the end, beginning, middle and end. It is meaningful and well-phrased. And meaningful here, the Pali is sa-atta. Atta means like goal, purpose of the path. Yeah, it is what we are trying to achieve. It is where we're heading, in a sense. So it has a real goal. That's another way of thinking about the Dhamma here. Meaningful is a bit vague, but it has a real goal. This is kind of what is, in a sense, kind of unique with the Dhamma from a Buddhist point of view. Everything I say is from a Buddhist point of view, of course. But from the Buddhist point of view, if you believe in a theistic religion, that there is some kind of supreme god or whatever, then actually you still haven't left samsaric existence. If you are a good believer in Brahma, the Almighty, okay, I'm going to believe in, I'm going to practice well, and then you practice accordingly, then you may have a very good rebirth, yeah? Because Buddhism says if you live with kindness, you have a good rebirth. But you don't exit samsaric existence. There is no real goal. After that, you will carry on in some other kind of rebirth, and you will go on. You haven't made an end of suffering yet. Whereas in Buddhism, there is actually a complete end of suffering, yeah? And this is, from a Buddhist point of view, what distinguishes the Buddhist teaching from really any other teaching, yeah? So it has a real goal, a real purpose. It's not just endless roaming around. Roaming means like aimlessness, right? To roam around, it's like aimless movement. If you kind of roam around the forest here, it means you have no kind of particular direction you're heading in. Buddhist idea is not to roam, it is to go in a particular direction that has a real goal at the end. So it is, has a real goal. It is well phrased. That's what it says, yeah? I can't actually see a blur on my screen, but... So it is well phrased, yeah? The Buddha puts a lot of emphasis on phrasing the Dhamma in the right way. It is careful. Sometimes you see in the suttas the Buddha goes on retreat. What does the Buddha go on retreat? He's already enlightened. Well, maybe this is part of what he does. He's figuring out how to maybe phrase or how to structure his teaching. Maybe this is part of what he does. Immediately after his awakening, according to some suttas, the Buddha just stayed at the place of awakening for quite a while, for several weeks. What did he do? Well, maybe what he did was to figure out, how am I going to express this, right? Because an insight doesn't come with a kind of vocabulary. It doesn't come with kind of how you're supposed to categorize these things. It doesn't come with five khandhas and seven factors of awakening or the five hindrances. All of that he has to make up, right? So how am I going to express this? This is really profound. Don't know how to talk about this. And of course, the Buddha is able to express even the most profound truths of nature, and that is what kind of makes the Buddha so special. People often say that even deep, profound experience of samadhi, like the jhana states, it's almost impossible to express these things in words because they are so otherworldly. But somehow the Buddha is able to get close to these experiences. You know, these are the jhana formulas in the suttas. So the Buddha's teaching are well phrased. He puts a lot of emphasis on getting it right. And that means that when you read the suttas, you read them with a sense of, okay, I should listen carefully then. Everything matters. I'm always surprised when I hear people say that, oh, I prefer to read kind of the modern teachers, yeah, because, oh, the language is so beautiful, you know, it draws me in, oh, it's easy to read, the suttas, oh, not too difficult, yeah, too abstract, can't really relate to it. But to me, it's the other way around. To me, when I look at many of these modern teachers and I read it, initially it seems beautiful and nice, and some people are very articulate and they can write very beautifully. But then when you try to fully understand what they're saying, actually it's hard to understand. What does it really mean? What are they actually talking about? And they use fancy words, but what do they actually refer to? And sometimes it's kind of blurry and uncertain. Whereas the Buddha's words are very consistent and they are used in the same way across the board. And after a while, you get this feeling of this kind of big picture where all the little bits fit into this big picture in a sense. And it's phrased very carefully with very precise categories, very structured in its approach. So I find that the word of the Buddha is far more lucid, far more transparent, far easier to grasp than almost any, actually, than any modern teacher. And this is, to me, one of the benefits of reading the suttas, precisely that it is so precise and well-phrased, etc. To me, this is, I think, one of the kind of beautiful aspects of the Buddha's teachings and why it's always useful to come back to these teachings. And then he says at the very last here, he reveals a spiritual practice. This is the Brahmacharya, the Brahma practice, that is entirely complete and pure. So entirely complete means that there is nothing missing, yeah, in the Dhamma. You don't need to add anything else. You don't need to add some, you know, whatever it might be. It is complete in its own right. All the factors you require for awakening are there. That is good to know, because people like to add things to the Dhamma and kind of come up with new things that, you know, aren't really part of this, and so we should be on lookout for that. But not only is it complete, the other thing is that there is nothing superfluous. Nothing is missing, and there's also nothing superfluous. And that means you can't really take things out. You can't say, yeah, rebirth, don't like that. If you chuck out rebirth, there's a problem, because it is the teaching is complete, there's nothing superfluous. Well, it means that it is important to take into account. If you cannot believe in rebirth, at the very least be open to the idea, at least reflect about it. And if you have to reject it, well, so be it, you have to reject it, but try at least to kind of see if it makes sense. That's what I recommend people if they find it hard to get their heads around these things. It is not that we have to believe things, that is also wrong, obviously, but at least investigate carefully. Also things like Samma Samadhi, the jhanas, the deep meditations at the end of the path, that too is not really optional. It is one of the most important things in the Dhamma. You can hardly read a sutta without the jhanas being mentioned. Very, very important parts of this teaching. Nothing is superfluous. So again, it makes you think about the suttas in a new way. And everything here is important. Everything matters. And then the last one is that it is also completely pure. It is entirely complete and pure. So, in other words, everything in the suttas, they lead towards purity. Yeah, it is all the aspects of purity are there. Again, there's nothing missing here. And to me, this is always one of those kind of marvelous things about the suttas. It is very difficult to justify anything bad when you read the suttas. It's very difficult to justify violence, for example, in the world. Very difficult to justify going to war. Very difficult to justify bad speech. Yeah, there's a purity going through these suttas, through and through and through, which is very, very attractive about the way the Buddha speaks. It has an incredible sense of integrity to it, these suttas. And that to me is very, very attractive and very beautiful. And sometimes you do hear Buddhist people, and it's kind of very sad when this happens, but you do sometimes hear people, monastics even, who are willing to justify violence and war in the world. When they do that, they don't use the suttas because it's impossible to find justification in the suttas. But they will find that in some kind of later scripture, yeah? And I can even show you where people do find these things. But in some later scriptures, you do occasionally find some dodgy things. But in the suttas, never. Yeah. All right, let's do just a little bit of meditation together, have a little bit of a break. Okay. So, are there any comments or questions? Maybe if we can, please, let's keep it on topic, I think, because otherwise it's going to take too much time. And then we can kind of have the more general discussions in the evening here. So anything anyone would like to say about what we have been doing here this morning? Yeah. Yes, please, sir. Yes, yes, you? Yep. Yes. Yeah.
So that, like when you said, sometimes they might have bad experiences.
Yeah.
So that they can always talk to the teacher who can guide them.
Yeah.
Especially when you are new meditating yogi.
Yeah.
We have lots of expectations.
Yeah.
Like in the education system, we are trained always to have, you know, some games.
Yeah.
So that we can might not know what to expect. So I just wondering what your thoughts
are. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. I think that's true. It's very important to have a good teacher and to have some ideas about what to expect and all these kind of things. Often the teachers that you find are not as good as they should be, ideally. And so because that is the case, sometimes it is good to also take a bit of responsibility for one's own meditation and to know that, have some ideas. You know, sometimes you get some really crazy instructions, like you're already feeling that you're going really funny in your meditation. Your mind is kind of going funny and they tell you, just keep watching. Yeah? And then you actually go psychotic. Yeah, this is actually quite well known in certain meditation systems and teachings. So trust your own intuition sometimes. This does not feel right. Yeah, this is heading in the wrong way. Okay, I'm going to withdraw a little bit from this because, and it's really that is, I think, the, you know, the kind of the, when you feel, especially when your mind is going, starting to go a bit funny, you're going a bit disturbed or you're getting more angry and it's not heading in the right direction, always kind of withdraw a little bit at that point. So yes, have a good teacher, but also take responsibility and know if the teacher may be a little bit not dodgy or something, if you know what I mean. Yeah. So. Where's the sun coming? Where's the sun coming from? Is it coming from over here? From over there?
Yeah.
Oh, wait, there's nothing we can do about that one. I was going to pull something down for you, but there's nothing we can do. Okay. Gee. I thought I was going to do an act of service, but so much for that. My intention was good anyway. So, so sometimes you can't win that. Do you want to? You can shift, move seats if you like. Yeah, it looks very uncomfortable to be like sit like that. So please move. Yeah, good. Yes, please.
From Insight Meditation.
I know him a little bit. I just visited him recently in the
I feel like you said that like the Buddha never made a claim to discover like the truth because that would put him kind of in opposition of some of the other teachers. He didn't want to engage in like a back and forth of I discovered the ultimate nature of reality or I discovered the truth.
Yeah.
Is that your understanding? He does say, I see things as they are.
Yeah.
You could say, well, that what's the difference? But
yeah.
It seems to be like the Buddha didn't want to make a claim on ultimate truth.
The thing is that I have to be careful with how I use words, and maybe when I say, you know, he discovered ultimately, it sounds a bit kind of highfalutin, and it's a very imprecise way of putting things, really. And I have to probably confess that I should be a bit more precise. But what he did discover is the nature of what it means to be a human being, right? And that the essential thing that he discovered, and this is kind of thing, is the idea of non-self, that there is no abiding essence in a human being. And so when I say discovering the nature of other, that's really what I'm referring to, this insight into non-self. But you could argue that this actually is an insight into the nature of reality, because what is reality anyway? Yeah? And for me, reality is experience. Yeah, you have your experience, I have my experience. And apart from our subjective experience, is there really anything else? Is that not what reality is? And I will argue that that actually is what reality is. Yeah? Reality is our own personal experience. And so once you start to understand your own personal experience, what it is, and what you understand about your personal experience is that it is non-self, it is impermanent, yeah, and it is suffering. Those are the three things you understand about that experience. So if your experience is reality, you have actually discovered the nature of reality through those three characteristics of existence. And that's what I'm referring to when I say that. So, does that make sense? Yeah, think about it, and please come back to me later on if you wish to kind of bring it up again. You know, I'm very, very happy to have discussions about these things. So. Yes, please.
I think I kind of agree with Father Venerable.
Yeah. The Kalama Sutta.
Kalama
Sutta, right, okay, yeah. Yeah, sure, yeah.
He said, don't trust it because it's believed in by other people, don't trust it because you see it, because you see it for yourself. And then also, didn't the Buddha, for Bhikkhu, use it, correct me if I'm wrong, the Jains were around at the same time, right?
Yeah.
Still give out gifts to Mahavira.
My
understanding I was reading the suttas were that the Buddha never claimed to be an absolutist with Buddhism.
The thing about the Buddha is that this is kind of the point. He has this bird's eye view, right? All he really claims, I suppose, is to understand these other teachings about, you know, what they are in from that perspective of his own discovery. From the perspective of his own discovery, he can then say something about these other teachings because they kind of shed light on everything around him. But he's not absolutist in the sense that, you know, to be I'm not sure exactly what you mean by absolutist, but he's not absolutist in the sense of, you know, to be happy in the world, you have to be a Buddhist, or, you know, Buddhism is the only thing that kind of will lead you to certain happinesses or whatever. But he is absolutist in the sense that if you want to find awakening, you have to follow the Noble Eightfold Path. You're not going to find awakening without the Noble Eightfold Path. Do you have to be a Buddhist to follow the Noble Eightfold Path? Well, not really. You just have to follow the Noble Eightfold Path. Yeah, whatever you call yourself doesn't matter. But there is a path that leads to awakening. And if you don't follow that path, you're not going to get there. Huh? Yeah?
So that's the only way.
Yeah, because it's like, you know, it's like there are, I mean, it's like a path. It's like anything you want to achieve in the world, a goal. Yeah, there is a way of achieving a goal, and awakening is the result of a certain process. And if you don't follow that process, it's not going to happen. Huh? So the Noble Eightfold Path is the way to do it. I mean, you could argue you can maybe make it 9 factors, you can add another factor 10 or whatever. I mean, you could do things like little things like that, but you can't take things out. You can't say, okay, I'm just going to skip mindfulness, right? Mindfulness is irrelevant. Forget about that. If you do that, it's not going to work, right? So you can't cherry pick the factors. But you can arguably add a few things, right? Because obviously adding is, there are different ways of expressing the Noble Eightfold Path. You could express the same path through more factors or in different ways or whatever. Or you could maybe say that, instead of saying right speech, right action, right love, you could just call it morality. You can make it into one factor, for example, right? I mean, you could do things like that. Yeah, but you still have to do the basic practice that is involved with the Noble Eightfold Path.
You said something else earlier, which teacher, he remembers you. I don't know if you remember him. Bhikkhu Chintita.
Bhikkhu Chintita. He's down in Texas or something. Is that right? Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I remember him actually. But yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
He said he was super jealous when you guys were in Singapore. But, like there was a bunch of TVs with your face on it.
All right. Okay. Yeah.
I came to him.
Yeah.
But this year has been a really rough year.
Right. Okay. Yeah, sure. Of course. Yeah.
So I was having something called the Dark Night of the Soul.
So say it again? Yeah.
The Dark Night of the Soul.
Dark Night of the Soul. Right. Okay. Yeah.
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 And he walked me through. And I, you know, he was ordained in Burma, so obviously. He led me through a certain set of practices, and it was more like Mahasi style of knowing to get me through that back to what I practice, which is Ajahn Chah's form of meditation.
Mm.
So, I don't know if that's something that you
can do. Yeah, great. If it works, if it gives good results, you know, good. There's nothing, you know, there's no kind of, one way. In this case, you know, meditation can be done from many different angles, you know, and noting is kind of what they use in Mahasi. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily recommend it as a final method, but certainly sometimes it will work, sometimes it will be good. Yeah, and I don't have a problem with that. And so, of course, there is a degree of diversity here, absolutely, yeah. And it's not good to be too fundamentalist about things. If you get too fundamentalist, this is the only way, everything else is wrong. It's kind of that's usually also a bad idea, because things come usually in degrees. Yeah, this idea of wanting to make things into absolutes is usually a bad idea from my perspective. So
you don't think you should truck through the meditation, because that's what you was telling me. It was like, don't start meditating. We got to figure out a way for you.
Say again. You. I was telling you to push through it with meditation. All right. I would not recommend that. Yeah, especially. But most, it depends on pushing through what exactly, what you're pushing through. But if it starts to feel that you are getting deluded or you're getting some very difficult mind states, if you push through that, it can lead to psychosis basically, and that this happens quite regularly on meditation retreats, people becoming psychotic because they are told, I'm feeling really fun, I'm feeling out of it, I'm feeling like I'm going nuts, keep on watching, and then you go nuts. Yeah, and that's kind of a bad idea. Yeah, it's not helpful for anyone if you go nuts, especially not for yourself. So I would say be gentle with yourself, be careful, especially if you're going through, as I say, the dark night of the soul, and I can understand that if you have a Ukrainian background, that's going to be difficult. So be kind to yourself. That's really important. Okay, let's carry on, and please bring up some of these larger issues. We can talk more about these larger issues later on today. So coming to the next paragraph here, a householder hears that teaching, or a householder's offspring, it says child here, but it doesn't really mean child, it means like this next generation, or someone reborn in some good family. They gain faith in the realized one, and they reflect, living in a house is cramped and dirty, but the life of one gone forth is wide open. It is not easy for someone living at home to lead the spiritual life utterly full and pure, like a polished shell. Why don't I shave off my hair and beard, dress in ochre robes, and go forth from the lay life to homelessness? After some time, they give up a large or a small fortune, a large or a small family circle. They shave off the hair and beard, dress in ochre robes, and go forth from lay life to homelessness. So this is what happens if you hear the Dhamma, right? You hear the Dhamma, you start thinking, oh, maybe I should become a monk or maybe a nun. Yeah, this is kind of what happens. And I know there are people here who are thinking about becoming monastics, and it's always nice when that happens. Yeah, it means that you're really starting to get what this is about. So this is what we are seeing here. So a householder's child, again, is just means like the second generation. Doesn't mean like a young kid. That's not what it means, because that you can't really go forth until you're 20. It just means that you are not, you know, you're not the most senior in that household. That's really what it means. So when you hear that Dhamma, yeah, you gain faith in the realized one, in the Buddha. Yeah. And so this is interesting here. Yeah. What does it mean to gain faith in the Buddha? Is faith even a good translation of the word that we're seeing here? Yeah. The word, the Pali word behind this is saddha. And the word saddha doesn't mean faith in the way that we normally use it in the kind of Western context, where Christianity has kind of been the majority religion for generations and generations. Because faith here has more, it includes perhaps some aspects of the idea of faith, but really it is a reference to the idea of confidence. You gain confidence in something. And confidence has a very different feel to it than the idea of faith, right? So we need to bring in the idea of confidence here. So how does that confidence arise? Well, it arises first of all from hearing these teachings, yeah, to thinking, wow, this actually makes sense. Yeah, and so that's kind of obviously a very important part of it. It's like almost like an intellectual kind of assent to what is happening to these things. But it's also the idea of watching a person. Yeah, if the Buddha says the world is in this way, does his way of acting, does that match with the way he speaks? Or is there a divergence between the way he speaks and the way he acts? And according to the Buddha, the way he speaks and the way he acts are always in conformity with each other. Yeah. They should not diverge. And one of the kind of dramatic things that we find, which I think is quite unique in the history of religion and spirituality, is where the Buddha in the Vimamsaka Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 47, Vimamsaka means investigating, yeah? So it's like the investigating sutta, where the Buddha says to his disciples, investigate me. Look if you see anything bad. Are there any qualities in me that suggest that I get angry, that I have ill will, that I have desires, that I'm deluded and confused? And that's kind of, I don't know, there's something very powerful about that, that you actually, our job as Buddhists or spiritual seekers or Buddhist incliners or whatever, however you think of yourself, is actually to investigate not just the teaching but also the teachers. Yeah. So we should be very careful. If we see things that look dodgy, then we should withhold our confidence a little bit, because it does not make any sense to have full confidence when you see dodgy things. It doesn't mean you should jump to conclusions either, because that's also kind of dangerous, but at least you should withhold your confidence a little bit. And this is what the Buddha says about himself. Yeah. So the gaining of confidence, or the gaining of faith, comes from this double thing. On the one hand, understanding the message makes sense, and also looking at the messenger. Is the messenger worthy of that respect, worthy of that confidence? And those two things, when they come together and they align together, that is when things become very interesting. So what is this saddha, this confidence, what is it about? And there is two sides to the saddha. One is the confidence I've been talking about now, just the idea of understanding the teachings making sense, seeing that the teacher lives up to the ideal of those teachings, right? And of course, as you practice this path, as you follow these teachings, and as you see they work for you, as they, as you kind of, the more you read of them, the more you kind of see this, all these bits and pieces fitting together into one overall picture called the picture of the Dhamma, called the picture of the Four Noble Truths, of awakening, whatever you want to call it. The more you see that, the more likely your confidence is to grow, especially if your own practice fits in with this whole idea. And this idea of confidence growing is a very important part of the idea of Dhamma, right? And what you are, another way of thinking about that is to say that your wisdom is growing. Yeah? Because as you are practicing this path and you're seeing that these things are true, well, what you are seeing is you are seeing aspects of what the Buddha himself discovered. You're seeing that when you meditate, lo and behold, you do become peaceful. You do find joy on this path. When you look at the nature of reality, you do see impermanence. You do see the suffering and the problems in the world, right? And you start, these things start to fit together. And this is, of course, why the confidence becomes stronger. And so in Buddhism, confidence and wisdom are two sides of the same coin. Faith and wisdom are two sides of the same coin. They're not really to be distinguished from each other. And this is also, again, quite unique in the history of religion, because in religion, usually, the idea of faith is kind of one thing. Faith, you have it regardless of whether it makes sense or not. That's not the point of faith. The point of faith is just to believe that, you know, God exists or something like that. But in Buddhism, it should always be a tempered kind of faith, tempered by reality, tempered by wisdom, tempered by right view. All of these things are sides of the same thing, yeah? Faith, wisdom, right view, reality, all of these things are the same. And this is why confidence and faith grows as your spiritual practice grows and as you get more insight into the nature of things. So that's kind of fascinating. And when does your faith become the most powerful? Your faith becomes the most powerful when you have the same insight as the Buddha had. When you see what the Buddha saw, in other words, you see the nature of your mind, you have an insight into non-self, at that point, your faith becomes, it is called the avechapasada, and avechapasada means like confirmed confidence, or confirmed faith, because you have no doubt anymore. Confidence and wisdom, faith and wisdom, align perfectly, and it merges into one thing. So isn't that kind of cool, yeah? So faith is not some kind of blind thing at all. Faith in Buddhism is about seeing, it's about understanding. Yeah? So why does he translate faith, saddha, as faith? Maybe he should use confidence instead. And I've had so many discussions with Mantasujata, because we are close friends, and it's impossible. Usually he can't be budged, right? He's, you know, this is the way, And actually, occasionally he can be budged, but not usually, like most people, he has kind of very strong ideas. It's not as if he has thought about this for the first time. You better come up with some pretty good arguments to convince him. And that's fine. I don't have a problem with that at all. But why does he translate it as faith? And the reason why he does that is that there is an aspect to this confidence that has to do with emotions, right? So if you really have confidence in the Buddha, and if you understand that this Dhamma is going to take you to happiness and leave suffering kind of in the dust behind you, and you start to understand that this path actually works, it starts to become, you feel this, right? It's like, wow, I'm so lucky to have a teacher like this. It is like, you know, you get a good job or something and you feel really ecstatic. Yeah, I got this really nice job. I'm going to work here for the BCBS, right? Yeah, this is the best place in the to work in the world. It's pretty good to work here, I have to admit. You're pretty lucky if you work in the office over there at BCBS. It doesn't get much better than this. But that makes you happy. That's nothing, right? That's a tiny amount of happiness compared to what you get in the Dhamma. So suddenly you occasionally get this feeling that, wow, I have touched really here something extraordinarily profound, something really meaningful, something that is going to give my whole life a certain direction, a goal, a purpose, something really to live for, whether as a lay person or as a monastic or whatever it is. And when you feel that, you're going to feel inspired, you're going to feel joyful. And in that sense, the word faith is actually appropriate, because the idea of faith often has this idea of joy and inspiration coming with it. So I think that is why he translates that faith. And I don't really blame him for that. I don't blame my good friends. So so that's okay. I forgive him. But remember, so it is this kind of this word that straddles the ideas of confidence and faith. Yeah, this is kind of what this word saddha is about. And it also, within it, also includes wisdom and right view and reality itself, understanding things according to reality. All of that is really included within this. So it's very broad and very interesting and very kind of one of these unique perspectives of Buddhism. Buddhism has many, many unique perspectives on the world that you don't really find in any other spiritual path or philosophical direction or whatever. There's something quite unique about Buddhism, and which I find extremely attractive. Before I was a Buddhist, I was nothing. I was kind of atheist, maybe, or agnostic, or something like that. But Buddhism was far better than atheism. Okay, Buddhist. So I actually, it's funny because I still, even now, I can consider myself kind of an atheist, you know. I'm a kind of an atheist Buddhist. It's kind of a weird combination, but anyway, let's get back to that later on. That's kind of being a bit of a sidetrack. Yeah. All right, so you gain faith in the Buddha in this way, because you hear his teaching, you watch his conduct, and then you reflect. Living in a house is cramped and dirty. Is that true? It's true. You say it's true? Okay, well, that's amazing. You are very wise. You're very kind of interesting. So what does this mean? I'm going to expand a little bit on that, because it may not be obvious. Well, cramped is kind of obvious, right? You live in a space that you share with many other people. You have people around you. Even if you love those people dearly because they are your family members, it is confining. You feel psychologically you are close to other people. You feel a bit constrained by that, right? I know what it's like. I go back and visit my mother usually once a year, and she is a wonderful old lady, and she looks after me like, you know, really, really well, and it's wonderful. But when I live in her house, I feel more constrained than when I live in my little cootie. You know, the word cootie means like a hut in the forest. I have it in my monastery in Perth. I have a little cootie. It is the hall is about 7 square meters, actually, feet, square feet. 7 is about 10, it's about 70 square feet, is that right? 7 square meters? Yeah, about 70 square feet. Is that small? That's small, right? Yeah, okay, I got it right. So roughly 70 square feet. It's like 3 by 2 meters, something like that. Does anyone here understand meters? Yeah? Okay, you understand meters at the back there. Okay, good. Because I don't understand feet, and Americans don't understand meters. We have a communication problem here. But yards, a yard is fairly close to a meter, a little bit shorter. So it's about 3 yards by 2.5 yards, something like that. So it's a very small place. Anyway, so that's where you live. And I'm actually far more happy to live in this tiny little place by myself, to live in my mother's enormous house, just with her and me. Still, to me, it feels more confined. But it's also the way, it's not just the fact that my mum is there, but it's also kind of the way it is, the way a house feels, right? All the furnishings, all the stuff everywhere, it has a sense of, I don't know, it confinement to it. So this word confinement in the sutta, sambada, is used in connection with the samadhi states and the jhanas. And the Buddha says that if you want to be liberated from confinement, or here the word cramped is used, if you want to be liberated from confinement, you have to attain samadhi. So really, it is the 5 sense world, according to the suttas, that is this confined space. We are trapped in the 5 sense world. What we see around us all the time, what we experience through our 5 senses, traps us, narrows us down as human beings, and we are confined in this space. It may not feel very confined. I've just come from Australia, which is halfway around the world. I think if you drill down from Barry here and straight down, you pretty much emerge in our monastery in Perth. It's like almost the exact opposite side of the world. So it feels like a large place. You can travel around. But the confinement is more of a mental sort. We are limited by this. We're limited mentally. Our mind is kind of bound to these things. It doesn't really expand and become large and encompasses the whole world as you do if you attain a state of samadhi, or you have a lot of metta and compassion and loving kindness in your heart, and your mind kind of expands and encompasses everyone. So it's a confined space. So it is used for the household life compared with the life gone forth, and it's also used as a metaphor for the world or the five senses compared to the samadhi experience. Yeah, so you are confined because of the attachments, the holding-ons in ordinary household life. This does not mean that all lay life is the same. It certainly is not. It really depends on how you live your lay life. There are lay people who live almost like monastics. And some, I must admit, some lay people are very inspiring. I feel really inspired when I see some of the lay Buddhists in the world. I think it's marvelous how they live. And we shouldn't make any absolute distinction between lay people and monastics, because there's all kind of shades of gray here going on. And there are some monastics who live terribly, right? I mean, that's the reality. When you have hundreds of thousands of monastics around the world, of course they're going to be large groups who don't live all that well, right? And this is just the reality of humanity. We are human beings. This is how what human beings are like. So there's all shades here. But as a general principle, lay life is more cramped. Dirty here, raja, is like dusty. And dusty is a metaphor for the idea of defilements in Buddhism. Yeah, when you live in lay life because there are people around you all the time, and because you brush up against each other, and because you are surrounded by the sensual attractions of the world, far more likely for defilements to arise in the mind. Yeah, much more easy to get upset about things, much more easy to get attracted to all the things around you. So it is called the Rajapata, path of dust, is kind of the way it is explained in the suttas. So don't take that too personally. It's just the way it is explained in the suttas. So it's interesting, right? This is how the Buddha, anyway, talks about these things. So living in a house is cramped and dusty, but the life of one gone forth is wide open. It is one of those nice things about living in the small hut in the forest. Where I live in my little hut in the forest, I don't see anyone else. I can't see any other hut. Don't see anyone. I feel really secluded. The only things I see are kangaroos. Yeah, and they don't cause so many defilements. They're kind of neutral. Yeah, and perhaps you think kangaroos are cute, but actually not all that cute. That is always this. At a distance, things seem cute. When I come up close, actually, it's pretty. Like everything, the world is a pretty rough place, right? Kangaroos, they fight with each other, they are greedy, and when you see the reality of the animal realm, actually cuteness disappears very quickly. Sometimes they can be cute, of course, like animals can be, but the reality is much more complex than that. Anyway, bit of a side issue. So, life gone forth is quite wide open, and that is how I would say I experience it as a monastic. It is not easy for someone living in a house or a home to lead the spiritual life utterly full and pure, like a polished shell. Yeah, it is difficult if you live an ordinary house or life with family around you, all these kind of things. It's difficult to live this path fully. You can still practice this path to some extent. You can still make your household life in itself into a spiritual path, and please do so. If you're already in a committed household life, you don't have much choice. You're going to have to carry on with that. So make the most of it. And you can do a lot living a family life and do, you know, some meditation, live with kindness, make that household experience express that through kindness to your family members and all of these kind of things. There's a lot of things you can do. What the Buddha is saying, it is more difficult. It is more limited than living a more, a spiritual life more fully as a monastic, especially. But even certain ways of living as a layperson can approximate to that. So, living like a polished shell is more difficult. So, why don't I shave off my hair and beard? And this, in the early days, there were monks, and then when the nuns came around, there was only shaving off of the hair. No beard, they didn't have to shave off the beard. Dress in ochre robes and go forth from the home life to homelessness. Why don't I do that? Interesting idea. This is right intention on the Noble Eightfold Path, right? Right view has been established. You have understood the teaching of the Buddha, taken that on board. Right intention. Right intention here is the idea of renouncing the worldly life. yeah, to do something more with your existence. So here, the viewpoint here is from the viewpoint of the monastic life. But of course, a similar kind of thing can also happen with lay people, right? It's just that it's slightly different the way it is expressed. Right intention has the intention of renouncing is only one aspect of that intention. It can also be the intention of loving kindness or non-ill will, yeah, and of compassion or non-harming. Yeah. So these, of course, are something that is universal to us. And the idea of renouncing, lay people also renounce to some extent. When you take on the five precepts to live according to that, you are renouncing a few things, the things you cannot do anymore. That is also an act of renunciation. We're limiting the sphere in which we allow ourselves to express ourselves. Cannot do bad things anymore. Oh no, I can't do bad things. How can I deal with this? Okay, I'm going to try really hard. And so you try to renounce those bad things. Or you have more of an idea of, I'm going to be kind. And if you have a general idea of being kind, there's many things you cannot do, right? Or whatever it might be. So there's always a degree of renunciation there as well, also for lay people. All of these things are renunciation. And then after some time, you give up a large or a small fortune, you give up all your possessions, you're not really interested in those things anymore. You very often in monastic life, we just give them back to our family, yeah, and they kind of look after them in case we disrobe, we have something to fall back on, which can be useful. And you kind of give up a small or a large circle of family, family circle. This does not mean that you never visit them again, but you're kind of living a bit more on your own, a bit more... you cannot have a, yeah, you exist in a different way. And I think this is one of the most difficult things for parents to deal with. You know, you have a child who becomes a monastic. Actually, it's quite hard. My mother found it very difficult to deal with the fact that I became a monk. It was very hard to deal with. I don't think she fully realized that it was possible to, you know, come back and visit and all of these kind of things. And I think now she is okay with it, not a problem. You know, but initially, it was very, very difficult. The idea here is that when you become a monastic, it's good to go to keep contact with your family, to visit them. And if you do it well, it has a very powerful impact on your family. Because when you are close to other people... You are able to impact them in a way you cannot impact society in general. Yeah? So when I go back and visit my family, I realize that my potential for impacting them actually is very, very high, precisely because of the close connections that you have with them. And it's kind of fascinating. This is one of the things that was very, very, very powerful for me in my own monastic life, is the fact that when I started out, my parents were completely, they were aghast. What are you doing becoming a monk? You know, we didn't bring you up for this kind of, for this or whatever. You know, they were really, and they thought I was kind of being carried away in some kind of, you know, cult or something like that. They had no idea what was going on. So initially, very, very resistant to the idea of what I was doing. But over time, yeah, and a lot of that comes from the idea of treating your parents and your family in the right way, doing the right thing, not trying to convert them, anything like that. And gradually over time, seeing that change, that was extremely powerful for me, because I realized the impact of the Dhamma. If you do it in the right way, you live the Dhamma rightly, the Dhamma itself starts to work and something happens. Most of my family members became kind of... I'm not sure if they would call themselves Buddhist, but I mean, they were certainly leaning very, very strongly in that direction. Yeah, when I went back and visited my family, they would say, give us a Dhamma talk and do meditation together. And that's what I would do. And that's the most nerve-wracking Dhamma talk, is when the entire family is there. That's kind of, whoa, that is really scary. But at the same time, I felt so privileged, right, to kind of be able to teach your... And I'm very glad I had a family that was so open and reasonable. So that is the power of these Dhamma teachings, when you do it in the right way. So it is hard. You give up your family, but you don't really give them up. You give something back eventually that is far more important and far more significant. So there is like the Buddha, you temporarily withdraw from the world. But then you go back to the world again, and you give a gift that is far greater than anything that happened just from the withdrawing. And this is really what is going on here. So if you have a son or daughter or anyone in your family who wants to go forth, say, please go forth, please become a monastic. Yeah? What a wonderful thing it is that you're becoming a monastic. If you really understand what is going on, that's what you would do. Yeah? It's very fascinating in many traditional societies, like in Sri Lankan society. Yeah, you don't want the intelligent. If you've got an intelligent son or daughter, the last thing you want to do is become a monastic. Yeah? Right? Isn't that true? That's true in often anyway in Sri Lankan society or in kind of societies that have a Chinese kind of cultural influence. It's the same kind of thing, right? I know many because I travel a lot. I meet a lot of people, and they say the last thing you want to do is for my intelligent son or daughter to become a monastic. Yeah, whatever they do in life, that is not doctor. Yes, lawyer. Okay, engineer is fine, but not a monastic. That's the bottom of the list. That's the rock bottom. And if you get a son or a daughter that is a bit of a dum-dum, okay, then they can become a monastic, yeah? Then it's all right. Okay, you can go forth, yeah? You're going to be a burden on the family anyway. No, I'm not saying that. And that's how it is. And the reason why it is like that is because people don't really understand what the Dhamma is about, yeah? If they really understood, they would say to the most intelligent and most successful son, please, for goodness sake, get yourself into those robes, right? Now is the time to ordain, if they really understood what was at stake. And what I have found is that when you start to teach the Dhamma around the world, people who had this traditional outlook, they start to change, right? They start to understand the Dhamma in a new way. And that is actually very heartening when I see that. And then they come to me and they say, well, thank you so much for teaching us the Dhamma, because I used to think my son and daughter should never become monastic. Now I think they should become a monastic, right? And it's beautiful to see that transition, because that means that they have understood what actually really is at stake here. There's something very important at the stake. What is at stake is the meaning of life itself. What is at stake is the higher happiness, real happiness, not just the worldly stuff which you carry on in your life. You carry on with life and you die and you wonder what on earth happened. It's kind of pointless. Everyone does that. Do we want to do what everyone else does, or do we want to kind of try to extract ourselves a little bit from this mire called samsara? So, anyway, don't know if you are convinced by what I'm saying, but anyway, that's... So you go forth from homeless life, from the lay life to homelessness. So this is taking a long time, isn't it? I would be not making much progress here. Anyway, let's do a bit of more meditation together. Let's chill a little bit. Okay, everyone, so let's carry on. So, any quick questions or anything before we do something more with the sutta? Anyone want to say anything? Yes, please.
I've always had a bit of a problem with feeding the family. I know in Indian culture, when you reach a certain age, if the family was grown, you could go out into the woods and become a monastic or a spiritual seeker. But at what age is it appropriate to lead children? That was always my, in other words, we have a responsibility.
Okay, so you're saying that it's you should it's better to ordain when you're older, is that what you're saying? Yeah.
If you have children.
Yeah, if you have children, right. Right.
To just leave the children for your own benefit.
Yeah. True, of course, absolutely, we need to take those responsibilities seriously. Of course, you can't just leave your kids, you know, and they're going to starve and walk, roam the streets to and kind of find food. And I don't know, that would be kind of terrible. That would be very irresponsible to do that. Absolutely. And so, yes, we should take those things very seriously. And in fact, and this may be interesting if you know, the Buddha actually did the same thing. He took it responsibly as well. He didn't just leave his wife and kids, kid, as you may have been told by, you know, by kind of the legend of the Buddha mythology, because this is the kind of the expanded Buddha mythology. They had this idea that the Buddha, he kind of left the house of life in the middle of the night and he kind of kissed his wife and son goodbye and he got onto the horse Kantaka and rode off into the darkness. So, and that's nothing to do with what actually happened. Because when you go back to the early suttas we're talking about now, it actually discusses this problem very briefly, albeit, but it's actually in there. And what it says there is that he went forth even though his parents were crying and wished otherwise. So he didn't ride off in the middle of the night. He had discussed it with his family, right? And they had obviously come to the conclusion that it was acceptable in one way or another, even though they wished otherwise. And so his son and his wife or whatever, they would have been looked after because these were extended families and it wouldn't have been as if he just left them high and dry without any kind of income or anything like that. So there would have been a discussion going on there and it would have been decided, okay, even though you have a son or whatever, we, you know, we can look after that. And of course, later on, his son would also ordain, right, and become an arahant. So it kind of, it got some very good results ultimately. But in our current society, where we don't live in large families like that, our responsibility for our children and family is much greater. Yeah, much, much greater. And it's madness to think that you can just leave your kids behind. So if you have that one, yes, then you have to bring up your kids. And when your kids are kind of self-sufficient or whatever, then you can, you know, you can then think about becoming a monastic if you wish. But I would also say that as a general principle, if one has the opportunity, it is good to go forth at a young age, yeah, because then you have more energy and generally you have more ability to practice the path fully. So I don't wait till you are 80 years old, you know. It's although there are some people who ordain late in life and they have a lot of success as well, it's true. Jeepers. So thanks for that. Anyone else want to say anything? Yeah.
Do you want that table over there to put your laptop
over? I think it's all right. Maybe, yeah. Which table? This one here? It might be a little bit on the high side, actually. I think it's okay. Yeah. All right, I'll give it a shot. Okay, thank you very much. That's very kind of you. Much appreciated. Yeah, that's pretty good, actually. All right. So, anyone else would like to say anything? Yes, please.
How do you feel
Yeah. How would I think about that?
Yeah. Do you think it's alright?
I think it's good. Yeah, I think it's great. I think it is because, in a sense, you are... Maybe this is a nice teaching for your children, right? Because you are showing that, you know, even at the very end of your life, there are certain things that you value so highly that they are worth, you know, leaving, you know, becoming a monastic for. And I think that is a great teaching for the people around us. Just like it was a teaching for my family. It took a long time for them to catch up with it. But eventually, they kind of... So it depends on why they do it and how they do it, and many factors there, obviously. But if they do it in a good way, I think it can be a powerful message to the rest of the family, maybe. Did you have anything in particular in mind with that, or no?
No. Yes, I do.
Yeah.
It's in the process of getting formed right now. It's in the process.
Yeah.
I see.
Okay, good. Yeah. Okay, excellent. Yeah. So, yeah. Okay. Yes, please. Okay.
I'm curious from your experience or your beliefs, because it sounds like in the suttas, it's very like you can only become enlightened if you are a monastic. I don't know if there's any lay people that became enlightened in the suttas, but is it...
All right. So it's not about my belief here, really, because all of this is stated quite clearly in the suttas. It's there, part of the Buddhist tradition, really. First of all, it depends what you mean by awakening. There are four stages of awakening, right? There's stream entry, once returning, non-returning, and arahant. And so when you want to decide what is possible for lay people to attend, you have to talk about which stage you're talking about. So according to the suttas, anyone, whether you're a layperson ordained, you can attain the three lower stages of awakening. However, when you become an arahant, one of the things that you give up when you become an arahant is what is called the fetter of householdership. So in a sense, the moment you become an arahant, you don't consider yourself a householder anymore. Your mind has changed. You feel like a monastic. You feel like an ascetic. And for that reason, you cannot really live in a house in the way you did before, you know, in a family life or storing up goods, as it says in the suttas, like you did before. You basically want to live a different kind of free life. That is your entire mind is leaning in that direction. So even if you do become an arahant as a householder, which seems to be possible, the moment you do that, basically you are a monastic already. That's kind of interesting, right? So it's a psychological transformation that happens at that particular point. So that is the first thing I would say to that question. The second thing I would say, which perhaps is more interesting than is it possible, what is practically possible, right? That is kind of what it really comes down to. Where are you most likely to make this kind of breakthroughs? For example, you can walk from here to San Francisco, but it's more convenient to take the flight, right? It's going to take a long way to walk to San Francisco, and you might die on the way, so that's kind of a problematic. So this is kind of what this is about. What is, you know, the Buddha lays down the monastic life for a reason. And the reason why he lays it down, because this is the quickest and most kind of best way of achieving these things. But I think, you know, one of the things that we also underestimate very often is that it is the monastic life well lived that is a quick path. But if you live the monastic life and you don't live it well, then it doesn't have any power. Then it's better to live as a lay person and live the lay life well, right? Rather than living the monastic life badly. So when the monastic life is lived well, that is when it becomes the kind of best path towards awakening. And that's why the Buddha always laid it down. Yeah? Okay, good. Do you believe that? No? Okay, no. I'm being silly. All right. Let's carry on there. And then if you have any more questions, please, we can take those this evening. Well, time is going quickly. So now this person has decided to become a monk or a nun. Yeah, they shave off their hair and half the time the beard. And then they put on the ochre robes and they go forth. Yeah, so this is kind of right intention, right? And once you have right intention, that has a certain effect on how you live your life. And now come the morality aspects of the Noble Eightfold Path. They are right view, right intention, now come the right speech and right action afterwards. So once they have gone forth, they take up the training and the livelihood of a mendicant, of a monastic. This starts by they give up killing living creatures, renouncing the rod and the sword. They are scrupulous and kind, living full of compassion for all living beings. So this is an expanded idea of the first precept. Yeah, is everyone here familiar with the five precepts? Yeah? Okay, great. Wonderful. I'm very happy to hear that. And the five precepts is very simple, right? It's Panatipata, Virapmanisikapadang, Samadhyama. I undertake the precept to abstain from killing living beings. But this is a much more expanded version, right? It says much more about what you're supposed to do. And so this is much more interesting in a way because it gives you the details about what you should be doing here. So first of all, you take up the training and the livelihood of a monastic. So the training of the monastic is basically what we're seeing now, is this whole gradual training. It also includes, of course, all the rules, etc., you have to keep and all of that kind of stuff. But the rules are not the most important thing. The most important thing is the Noble Eightfold Path. The livelihood of a monastic is basically having an alms bowl and walking into the village and collecting alms, right? I do that every day here. I would go up to the local village up there and I collect my alms up there at 11 o'clock. And I'm doing that soon. And so I go there and I go into the kitchen and they offer me the food and I take some food and I go back. It's the same kind of idea. That's the livelihood of a monastic, carrying your alms bowl around. So you're not supposed to do anything for a living as a monastic. I'm not supposed to provide you with a service and then you kind of give me something in return. That is not the monastic way. If I do that, it's called wrong livelihood on the monastic's part. So that's the beginning of it. And then the first thing of this training is that you give up killing living creatures. That includes all living creatures, right? It includes things like mosquitoes. Regardless of how irritating that mosquito is, you are lying at night, there's a mosquito in your room, you can't fall asleep because you feel the buzzing of that mosquito. Has that happened to anyone, ever? Happens to everyone, right? That's when you really need a lot of compassion, yeah? And you have to remember that this is a creature, it wants to stay alive, yeah? It's and once you kind of get a little bit into the mind of the mosquito, and you understand, just like us, yeah, they want to be alive. They don't know that you are a human being. They don't know that they're irritating. They just want a meal, yeah? And fair enough, how can you blame them for that? And so you need to change your attitude, look at the world in a slightly different way. You need to kind of anthropomorphize these creatures a little bit and see kind of their, almost like they, maybe saying, seeing that humanity is going too far, but you want to see their aspects in the creature are similar to what we have in as humans. And then you can start to have compassion and you start not to be so concerned about these things anymore. You take these things very seriously about looking after all creatures in the world. Yeah, this is kind of the Buddhist way. It's a very beautiful way of thinking about the world instead of thinking that animals are just automatons. You know, one of the things that we know from modern science is that animals are becoming more and more like human beings. Maybe in the Middle Ages, when Europe was still in the kind of was very much confined by the ideas of Christianity, maybe people still thought of animals like machines that didn't have any feelings, even though it should be obvious that they have feelings. But anyway, maybe that was the idea. But the more kind of science is catching up with the reality of animals, we are seeing that they are very similar to human beings. They have feelings, they get sad, they get depressed, they get happy. Yeah. How can we deny their rights? It's kind of crazy. We need to have more animal rights in this world. And I think that is kind of where we are still lacking a lot in our society. So you start to have more compassion for animals, more understanding that they too experience the world in many ways similar to us. And as you do that, it becomes quite easy to live up to these standards. And then you may choose to become a vegetarian as well. That is not an absolute requirement in the suttas, and people sometimes find that strange. But a large part of that is because the Buddha, as a mendicant, he accepts food from anyone who gives it to it, gives it to him. And so then he, you know, he doesn't lay down any absolute rule on meat eating. Yeah. But I think, generally speaking, being a vegetarian is a nice idea, and I would, if someone suggested to me, I would certainly support them in that. So you renounce the rod and the sword. Yeah, the rod here is danda in Pali, and danda, just like rod in English, has this idea of punishment. Yeah, you punish people with the rod. So in a sense, you are giving a punishment as well. We don't really punish people anymore. This is one of the beautiful things in the monastic sangha. There isn't really any. There is no such thing as physical punishment. Just absolutely not existing. Yeah. And if you really kind of go way beyond what is acceptable, one of the worst things that can happen to you is you get expelled from the sangha. You lose your membership because you do something which is completely contrary to the idea, like killing someone. If you kill somebody, then you're out of the sangha. You're finished. And that is kind of the extent of punishment. So is that punishment, or is it just a way of making sure the sangha has integrity, that it doesn't fall apart? Yeah, there is a kind of a line to be drawn there somewhere. Yeah? So so we give up the idea of punishment, especially physical punishment. There isn't really any scope for that in Buddhism. Rod and sword are given up. But then, so that is like giving up all the negative things. And you notice here that we are doing more than just not killing. Giving up the rod, giving up punishment, means that we're also giving up hurting animals, right? It's not as if hurting people or hurting animals is okay, but killing them is not okay. Hurting is also bad. It kind of expands the scope of the first precept. Hurting is bad. But then comes the interesting part, and that is that we should not just avoid doing all the bad things that are driven by bad motivations, but we should be doing all the good things, right? We should be scrupulous and kind. We should live full of compassion for all living beings. This is really kind of the highway of morality in Buddhism. The idea of expressing everything we do in good ways, avoiding the bad, doing the good. And it's when this comes together that we're really practicing Buddhist morality to the full. Remember that. This is such an important part of this path. If you avoid doing the bad, it means that you won't feel any regret. But if you do deliberately do good, you will actually start to feel good about yourself as a consequence, because you know that you are treating other people with kindness. So remember that. Yeah, take the opportunities. When you see opportunities to be kind to anyone, take every opportunity, right? The smallest little things that you do. And there is actually quite a bit of kindness in our society already. I'm often, surprised when I just sit down and I just observe people, and I actually see a lot of kindness in this world. That's wonderful. It makes me believe in humanity. If you just watch the news, you kind of lose all your belief in humanity. But if you watch real people rather than watch the news, news is artificial, yeah, because it is the worst aspect of humanity kind of put into half an hour segment, yeah, and that's what you see. That's not what the real life is like. Real life is this. This is seeing real people around you, coming together, meditating, and living well. This is real life. What you see on the news is just a digest of the worst stuff in humanity. It's not really worthwhile that much of our attention. This is real life. And when you look at humanity, actually, it's surprising how much kindness you see in the world. I was surprised. I was just in San Francisco recently before I came here. I've been all across the United States on this kind of whirlwind tour. It's been good fun, actually. It's been really nice to come. I've never really been much to the United States before. So it's been very nice to be here. And, as a monastic, you always get treated with a lot of kindness and things. So it's wonderful. You get to meet many wonderful Buddhists. But in San Francisco, I was driven around by this fellow who has been at our monastery before, and he happens to live in that area, and he was very happy to drive me around. And at a certain point, we had to stop on the highway. He had to fill petrol, not petrol, gas in his car, right? In Europe, in England, gas means like, the gaseous stuff, right? Petrol is what you fill into your cars anyway. So And so I just was sitting there in the car and I was just watching people, you know, and people walking in and out of this gas station. And they were kind of holding the doors open for each other. And it's people who are complete strangers to each other, never met before. And I could just see. And it was not just one, it happened with many people. And it kind of, you see that, ordinary people in society just doing the right thing and looking after each other in a good way. And just seeing that actually made me feel quite happy at that moment. I think, wow, that's really nice. I don't know if anyone would do that in my country. I think they're... or maybe they would actually, maybe I'm being too harsh on my fellow countrymen. But, and that is kind of beautiful. So remember that, take every opportunity to be kind. Because there's something about kindness that is not just good for you, but it's also good for the people who just observe it, the people who receive the kindness. We're all uplifted by acts of kindness. And it has a kind of ripple effect. If I'm kind to you, yeah? I haven't done much for you, but I'm going to try my best to be kind to you anyway, just by kind of whatever. And if I'm kind to you, then you feel good, and then you want to be kind to someone else, right? And it kind of ripples out. If you are kind to me, I think, wow, we have only known each other for a couple of days, but he's kind to me, okay, I'm going to be kind to someone else. And it kind of ripples out. And this is the beautiful thing about kindness in the world. It inspires us also to be kind to others. So never underestimate your kindness. Never underestimate how it actually moves through society in strange ways, and it has an effect on the world. It's powerful stuff, kindness, and remember that. And once you get that idea, you really start to apply it much more in your life. You take every opportunity. So this is a very important point here, and it has very significant consequences for how we think about Buddhist morality. Because what this really means is that our motivation, where we're coming from, is what matters. Yeah, if you come from compassion, if you come from kindness, you cannot really go wrong. Yeah, remember here it says that you are motivated by compassion. That's why you don't harm anyone, or you don't kill anyone, because you're coming from compassion. So the idea of, as long as we are driven by compassion and kindness, what we do will be right as a consequence. So motivation and intention is what is the ultimate decider of whether we're doing something that is morally right or morally wrong. And that opens up the ideas in Buddhism of what morality actually is. And it opens up our ability to deal with some of the modern ethical dilemmas in the world, like euthanasia. Is euthanasia okay or not? Well, if you do it in the right way, it might be acceptable, right? What about abortion? It's not a very interesting topic. Yeah, it's kind of hard to come to any... What is the Buddhist view on abortion? And again, it's very nuanced. It depends how we do it, and doing it in the right way, etc. It's a complicated question, abortion, from a Buddhist point of view. Stem cell research, yeah, is there a consciousness already that has arisen in those stem cells? How do we deal with that? And Buddhism shows us that if we are motivated by the right things, if we're coming from the right place, we cannot go morally wrong. That's what this is saying to us. That is very interesting, and it makes the Buddhist morality very flexible and very useful in the modern context. We can discuss these things more later if you are interested in that. Okay, just briefly, I'll have a quick look at the next ones here as well. So you give up stealing. You take only what is given. You expect, or rather you desire, only what is given. That's my preferred translation of that. You keep themselves clean or pure by not stealing. Yeah, so you stop stealing. This is then about, again, the monastic path. That's why you expect only what is given, or you desire only what is given. And of course, this takes the idea of not stealing to a higher level, because if you only desire what is given, it means that you don't even think of the idea of stealing. Yeah? It doesn't even occur to you that you should steal, because you understand that actually it's a very bad idea. So that's kind of taking it one step further. And you keep yourself clean or pure by not stealing. And the implication here is that there is a degree of impurity But you probably feel bad about yourself if you steal something, yeah? And it leaves an imprint on your mind that is going to be lasting, yeah? Now here, there is no positive counterpart. Why is that? Well, because the positive counterpart to stealing is generosity. Yeah? And generosity is a very important thing in Buddhism, right? It has its own kind of whole set of ideas around the idea of generosity, and that's why I think it's not mentioned here, because it's such an important thing that it has its own place on the path. So be generous, right, in your life. Generosity can take many forms. The standard way of generosity is, of course, to kind of give something material, yeah, whatever that might be. But generosity can also be thought of as a general idea of being caring and compassionate and giving to other people, yeah? So being generous is a very, very important part of life. How should we be generous, sir? It's a very interesting thing. If you want to give something to someone or something or some organization, how do we choose how to be generous, sir? And there is a very interesting sutta. There's many interesting ones. This is another interesting one, which tackles this particular topic. And this is King Pasenadi of Kosala. He goes to the Buddha and he asks the Buddha the very interesting question: where should I give? Right? Where should I give? And what does the Buddha say? You should give to me? Do you think he says that? It doesn't sound right. Yeah? If the Buddha said that, you might lose your respect for the Buddha. You should give to the Sangha of monks. Yeah, that's what. No, he doesn't say that either. Of course, it's going to be interesting, otherwise he wouldn't say this. So the first thing he says is, well, there's two different questions. One is, where should you give? And where is the most good karma from giving? Where is the most merit? These are two different questions. And that's already very interesting, because people think that the place we should give is where there is most good karma, right? Because we want good karma, right? So we should give there. No, says the Buddha, that is actually the wrong way of thinking about it. He says the place we should give is the place where we feel inspired, where we feel peaceful, where we feel compassion, where we feel that the mind inclines towards something. That is where we should give. Where the mind is passivity, the mind is kind of calmed down, and the mind clarifies, and the mind becomes confident. That is where you should give. So the place, what that means in reality, is that whenever you feel the urge to give, you feel inspired, I want to give somewhere, that is where you're going to find that inspiration, the calm, the peace of mind. Give, for goodness sake, yeah? The urge comes up, even if it's the beggar on the street, and you think, okay, I don't know what this beggar is going to do, but actually I feel compassion today. I don't know, I was just in New York City the other day, and I saw all these beggars on the street, and this is not just in New York, it's around the world you find these things these days, and it's terrible to see this. These are human beings, and it's just heartbreaking to see human beings living in this way. And if you feel that urge to give when you see someone like that in really miserable conditions, give, even if it's a beggar on the street, even if you don't know how they will use that donation of yours, yeah? Because you are coming from something inside which urges you to give. It is always the right time to give. Don't be too rational about it, because if you're too rational about it, you destroy some of the beauty of that giving. Of course, if you know that you're giving to a bad cause, then please don't do it. But if your heart is in the right place, give. And the reason why that is so powerful, I'm going to miss my lunch now, but never mind. The reason why this is so powerful is because if you give at those times, it's going to make a powerful impact on you. Because when you enjoy the giving, when you feel the compassion, your mindfulness is going to be strong, yeah? Because you are really present when you're happy with something. And when you are very present and you feel compassion, it's going to give a powerful imprint on your mind. And because it is a powerful imprint on your mind, when later on you try to recall anything good that you have done, you were able to recall it easily. And you were able to use it in your meditation to give rise to joy, to give rise to happiness. And then it encourages you to give more, right? And because it encourages you to give more, it then gives rise to a good habit. But if you become a calculating individual, think, yeah, where do I get the most merit? Yeah, where do I get the most good karma? Yeah, this is an arahant over there, stream mentor over here, an ordinary person. If I kind of give $10 there, one, or if I do it this way, then that is bad, right? It's too calculating. It doesn't come from the heart anymore. So coming from the heart matters so enormously. Yeah. Anyway, I've got to stop because I promised to be up there at 11 o'clock. So please, everyone, carry on meditating and enjoying yourself. Have a nice lunch. And we'll see you back again at 2 o'clock this afternoon.